Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kyle Beadle, and today we'll be talking with Marco Checchi about his book entitled The Primacy of Resistance, Power, Opposition, and Becoming. Marco Checchi is a lecturer in business and management at De Montfort University in Leicester. His research interests focus upon a postmodern conceptualization of the primacy of resistance in relation to management and organizational studies, with a strong attention to political philosophy and social science. He is also interested in alternative forms of organization and social and community-based entrepreneurship. Thank you, Marco, for being here today. How are you doing?
Thank you, Kyle, for inviting me here. Fine. Thank you for the introduction.
Thank you. And can you give our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So as you said, like I'm in a business and management department at the moment, but like my interests like a bit wider than that. So I come from a background in political philosophy, but also like I have a background like in activism and political practices. So my research like tries to focus on alternative ways of organizing. And by saying that, like I mean, like instead of focusing on the classic mainstream business and the classic way of managing businesses, like what I try to do is to explore all the other existing activities in which like there are forms of resistance that try to go against those mainstream classic organization and try to construct a new horizons of solidarity and emancipation, mutualism.
That's great. So what drew you to the concept of resistance and kind of how did that influence you writing this book?
It started like first I would say like as a sort of personal experience kind of thing, you know, like a natural attachment to the idea of resistance, like in the sense like I've always been like very active in terms of demonstrations, in terms of like political activism, a bit of militancy here and there in small projects. And then like I came across the work of Michel Foucault. I was studying political philosophy in my master, and then like I carried it on in during my PhD. And the idea of resistance that he develops is very interesting and way underdeveloped in comparison with like the attention that has been given to power in his work. His ideas on power, the ideas on power by Michel Foucault are really, really eye-opening because like they offer a completely different perspective on the traditional understanding of power in political philosophy. And it's something that really resonated with my own experiences, but the experiences like of generations of from the 70s onwards, in which like we understand that power is not just about the government or the state, but we find forms of power in many different aspects of our own lives. There is a way of reading Foucault that is always like a really negative in the sense of having the feeling that power is everywhere and so you're crushed by power. And instead, like I think like if you have a more attentive reading, I'm not claiming that my reading is better than others, but like between the lines, like, and also between like if you go through the interviews that Foucault was giving through his lifetime, there is that sense that resistance is a constant presence and is not just about power. Actually, it's the other way around. Resistance is a very strong presence that keeps changing the dynamics that in where power is at stake. And the way in which power changes is actually because of resistance. There would be no reason for power to change at all if there wasn't enough resistance pushing for that change to happen. So that's like where my interest came from. Like, and from there, I managed to connect with other bodies of thought and theories and philosophies in which these ideas of resistance were somehow there, maybe not explicit, but there were a lot of potential. There was a lot of potential that could be grasped from those other theories.
And so you mentioned Foucault there. Prior to your exploration of resistance, how was resistance kind of conceptualized?
In his work, you mean?
Right.
Yeah. Well, in his work, like, there is the very famous kind of dictum where he says, like, where there is power, there is resistance. Other than that, like, he has basically a chapter in the first volume of The History of Sexuality, The Will to Knowledge, like his book from 1976, in which he does give like some hints of what he means by resistance. I would say that like it still remains a bit cryptic, because like you need to make a lot out of like very few pages, where actually the concept is way wider than that. The way in which he conceptualizes it, like it starts like from an understanding of power as relational. So power is not just an entity that acts in isolation, but it needs to be to have like another element of the relation where power is acted upon. So there would be no power if there was no other force enforcing that power, making that power circulate. So we start from an idea that power is in a relation, is always in a relation between who, let's say, exerts power and who is subjected to that power. Now, most of our lives, like most of our actions, most of our behaviors, most of our routines are conditioned by power. So we do what is expected by what power wants us to do. Going to work every morning is like the best example of it. Like you go to work, it's like obviously there is a system in place in which like the relation there is a relation of power, or a series of relation of power that like somehow forces you to do it almost naturally. So you don't have anybody like forcing you to do that, like, but actually you've been forced to do it. Now, this is a relation of power. At the same time, there are a lot of occasions in our lives in which like we can sort of step away from that relation and find alternative ways of deciding about our lives and about our actions in a completely different way. And that's for me what resistance is about. So it starts from those very micro gestures of, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that in that way. I'm going to do it, but I really wouldn't want to. You know, like, and this is, I think, like, is an experience that even the most loyal and obedient subject on earth would still have on a daily basis. Like, those little moments in which, like, yes, that's what I'm supposed to be doing, but I don't really want to be doing that. You may end up doing it anyway, but you have, like, those tiny bits in which, like, there is attrition. And I think that's, for me, like, is the beginning of resistance. From those little moments of resistance, then you can connect other resistances in a strategic way. And then from those little moments, that you can get to a revolution. That's what, like, Foucault says as well. Like, it's a matter of coding. So there is a swarms. It's like, I really like the idea of these swarms of points of resistance, like or micro resistances everywhere, every day, in every aspect of our lives, in every aspect like of a country, of a nation, or whatever. And then those little experiences of resistance can actually get together, coordinate themselves, and get into a proper strategy that can change things in a macro way. Sometimes it happens. We've seen it in history. We see it in history all the time. Even like in times like with the COVID, right? Like where everybody thought like that we've been locked down, so there is no space for resistance. And we saw resistance flourishing everywhere. We've seen Black Lives Matter. how beautifully they managed to take the streets like for many days and bring something completely different to the ordinary routine and stability of power.
Right. And you try to make the argument too that resistance isn't always a response to power. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I think like this is like the way in which possibly my reading of resistance differs a bit from traditional understanding of resistance. Normally, like we have a conception in which like power is always there. Power is always there. And so what resistance can do is just react to that. And this is like a perception that to me is politically problematic because like it let us appreciate how it's difficult to fight power, but it doesn't let us appreciate how many resistance pop up anyway, everywhere. So despite all the odds, like a resistance like is always there. Like, and you're always going to be surprised. Like I gave the example of Black Lives Matter, but you can come up with million examples on a daily basis. There's always cases of like, oh, really? Is that happening? How? Where does it come from? And so I think like we should invert first from a strategic perspective, but also from a logical and conceptual perspective, we should invert the aspect in which we place power first and then resistance as a reaction. Is power that is actually a reaction to resistance? To resistance that are there or to resistance that might be there? So to put it in another way, if somebody's forcing you to do something, it's because you naturally wouldn't do it yourself. I mean, like if it's something that you would do anyway, there wouldn't be any need for any form of power that obliges you to get to do that. So it's all power exists always as a reaction to something that naturally, and I'm using the word naturally like in a bit like a liberal way, but naturally you wouldn't do it. So I think like that's like in the moment in which we can really understand this inversion. Resistance is not just about like saying no, but it's like about a way of life that is completely different from what power wants. And when I'm saying a way of life, I'm understanding a way of being together. So a way of being like together in a cooperative, emancipatory, and so in a way that is got solidarity as its main drive. And this working together is always interrupted by forms of power that tend to divide us, like to interrupt that flow of creativity. So we have, what I'm trying to do in the book is to present resistance as an affirmative force to which power reacts.
And you talk about that inversion of the concept of resistance as just being a response to power. And you kind of begin in chapter one by like defining a theoretical framework. Can you explain that for our listeners and kind of the power relations to resistance?
Yeah. What I do like in the first chapter is basically to trace the ways in which a resistance has been understood, not just as reactive, but also as oppositional. So being against something, right? Like this is like it's something that is sedimented also in the language, right? Like when we, in everyday language, as you says, like I'm resisting against this, this and that. Now, what I try to do is like to invert that reading and get to the point in which like it's power that is against something, while resistance tries to affirm and create alternative ways of life, alternative ways of being. And the way in which like the theories that I call upon basically draws like on Foucault, as I was saying earlier, and his idea of power relation and how these power relations can actually produce a system that is a bit static. So that produces a system in which like a hierarchy and divisions are settled. Instead, resistance is what brings a dynamic element of change into this this relationship. Now, it's not just like Foucault, obviously, but like it's in particular is the reading of Foucault that is given by Gilles Deleuze, so another philosopher from the same time, basically a former friend of Foucault, then they split up. Or in my opinion, I think like there is a sort of reconnection after the death of Foucault, especially in the lectures that Deleuze gives on Foucault in 1996, in 1995 and 1996, that are being recently transcribed and published by Purdue University, a group of Purdue University. And I think it's very interesting to see this kind of change and how it connects to actual struggles and resistances of that time. There is all a connection, theoretical connection, but it's also a practical connection with Italian autonomist Marxism and workerism, so operaismo, in which there was this idea that basically is at the core, and that I developed in another chapter, of like the relationship between labor and capital. So this is like more or less the theoretical framework where all this notion of resistance as first comes from.
Yeah, and you begin to talk about those closures that happen that kind of block resistance from being this primary means. And could you explain how the developments of like the Enlightenment in the 16th and 17th century kind of impede upon that affirmation?
Yeah. I basically devote the first part of the book like to these ideas of historical conceptual closures, like the idea in which like I think the idea of resistance as first, as the primacy of resistance was actually there, and then somehow it gets blocked. It's got like lots of potential, and then that potential is transformed into something else that actually goes into the opposite direction. So this is my understanding of closure. And in particular, I think on the idea of contractualism. So this those political philosophers that then eventually we'll find also in the Enlightenment that placed basically the state of nature as something that comes before the actual civil power. Now, this is like something that like any student of philosophy, a political philosophy, I believe is very familiar with. So like figures like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and then like you have also like more contemporary kind of versions of these like John Rawls. So all this liberal thought in which like we have a state of nature that is like disorder, anarchy, chaotic, like it's basically a place where nobody wants to be, especially like if you take Hobbes' version in which like you have this war of all against all. So like it's just like a disaster, like that everybody wants to escape. And in order to escape that, like you're willing to give up part of your freedom and go underneath like a civil power. So basically, this is the liberal idea of like passing from a state of nature to power. Now, it's interesting too, because like obviously I was not attracted by the war of all against all, bellum omnia contra omnes, like from Hobbes. But I was always wondering like, why would people have to fight each other? why is that so natural to think that human nature is at the level that like if there was no restraint, so if there was nobody controlling us, we would kill each other. Is that really natural? And by posing this question, and I actually found an historical antecedent of this kind of thinking that is like this possibly minor thinker from the 16th century, Etienne de la Boétie. It's like this French man that basically published only this work, like, and I think he was 18 when he wrote it, but actually it became really popular over the centuries, and is this discourse on voluntary servitude, in which basically he says something similar, like he says like there is a state of nature and then there is the actual power. But for him, the state of nature is not that dramatic like as Hobbes would want it, but it's actually a very beautiful place. So a place in which like there is cooperation, there is mutualism. It says something very interesting that it gets a bit lost in the English translation, but it doesn't say that we are free in nature as per se, but it says like we are free because we are all companions, we are all comrades. So as we are all comrades that can help each other, that's where our freedom comes from. And it's very beautiful because like he does like all these very imaginative ways of depicting this solidarity in which, like he says, nature gave us like different talents so that we could help each other. It was actually a way for developing like a mutual kind of support to each other. And I found that idea is like as an idea that in which what I called resistance, so a kind of life that is like again without power, comes actually before the actual coming to be a power. And he calls power a misfortune. I really like the idea. It's like at some point there is the misfortune, this accident, power happens, and then society is completely changed and we lose our nature. I find it really beautiful because like it gives like the idea that power is not needed per se. So power is not natural. What is natural is cooperation and solidarity. Then something dramatic happens and power begins. So it's actually the opposite that you find in Hobbes, for instance. Mm-hmm. And Hobbes, I think, like that's what I understand for a closure, is the way of taking that kind of thought, so this kind of temporal division between a state of nature and power, and turn it upside down, saying, we don't want the state of nature, we need power. So, and that, I think, like is a closure because, like, it keeps being driven by the idea of the primacy of resistance. Because in the liberal thought, there has always been, like, especially with the first thinkers, like this kind of state phobia in which power is there. It's something that we don't really like. But we don't really like, not to the point of anarchy, but never, we don't really like it, but we still want it. You know, like that's the kind of liberal kind of thought, liberal right-wing kind of thought in which like you have like, maybe power is a bit annoying, but we need it. And instead, like with the La Boétie, we find the opposite. So I find it as a closure of that kind of thought that gets buried into the deep secrets of political philosophy. And what comes to us instead is like Hobbes, Locke, and this kind of like subject of rights and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and then you kind of go into the problem of labor as well. You say, quote, the primacy of labor might seem the economic equivalent of the primacy of resistance, but you then go on to say that that isn't really true. So could you kind of explain how the primacy of labor blocks the primacy of resistance?
I think like is the evolution, what happens with that, and especially like in the moment in which from the primacy of labor we get, I make this connection with this idea of human capital. So the idea of the primacy of labor comes like from this Marxist tradition, especially like in the way in which it was applied in Italy in the 50s and 60s, and then later on in the 70s as well, like of operaismo, which is the idea of workerism. You have this philosopher and activist like Mario Tronti, which like he basically it turns upside down the classic Marxist reading of the economy, in which we have like capital comes first and then you have labor. Now, turning upside down this relationship is a really beautiful and interesting kind of way of putting it, because like it explains what labor is and what capital is. So capital, which is always given like as a prior to power, is instead like something that is derived from labor. If we understand capital basically as the accumulation of profits, those profits is basically dead labor. So it's that portion of surplus labor that is extracted from the labor process and it becomes a portion of capital. So there is this relationship in which labor actually constitutes capital in the first place, but also there is the level of in which labor becomes a form of resistance. So when organized labor and worker struggles push capital to invent other ways of development. And for instance, like you can think of any technological advancement. Like obviously technology is always like presented as this beautiful, neutral kind of progress, but instead very often are ways in which capital tries to exploit workers and extract profit and surplus value by protecting itself from worker struggle. So for instance, like, I don't know, you can think of any kind of technology of today, even AI, right? Like it's a way of like having capital being run by itself, by algorithms, so that like there is no way that workers can actually stop that production. So in a way you can see that like they had to find a way of protecting themselves like in order to suppress worker struggles. So this is like the idea that you find in the Operaista kind of thinking, and that's where the primacy of labor comes from. But at the same time, that primacy of labor is not just about labor. That's why I'm saying like it's not just the economic equivalent of a primacy of resistance, because it's much more than that. When you come to define labor in that way, so in the moment that labor is liberated by the relationship with capital, what you appreciate that is labor corresponds like to all the potentialities of human action. And in that sense, like you have this opening up like of the concept of labor, once it's liberated from actual capitalist production, you have like other ways of being creative and using your own potential to create stuff, other stuff, like other things. And this is like very similar though, and then that's where I get to the closure, the other historical closure, paradoxically, to the idea of human capital, in which basically everything we do as an individual can be turned into our own capital. So even our education, because education was like the way in which like neoliberalism presented this idea of human capital, education is functional, is instrumental for you to develop an income, basically a stream of income. But what changes dramatically is that like this idea of turning basically human labor into human capital, it basically destroys the antagonistic relationship with capital itself. So if we are all human capitals, like we fight each other and we compete with each other. So it takes away all the dynamic of solidarity that instead is expressed by labor, because labor is by nature cooperative. And instead, the relationship with capitals, between capitals, is by nature competitive. So it's the opposite of this solidaristic and mutualistic and cooperative relation that you find with a resistant way of understanding labor.
And after you look at these closures, you kind of look at contemporary theoretical openings for the primacy of resistance. So how does the work of Rancière and Negri create a theoretical opening for resistance?
Well, I think first of all, like, it's like I chose like Rancière and Negri as two thinkers that helped me out to take this primacy of resistance in a setting that is related to politics, and politics understood like in two very different ways, but like that converge somehow, but that have the power to connect with other aspects. So for instance, in Rancière, you find this connection between politics and aesthetics, while in Negri's work on Spinoza, which I find particularly beautiful, particularly inspiring as well, you have this connection between politics and metaphysics. So not just metaphysics, but like the a real ontology, so the whole space of being, which then I used to connect with in the final chapter. I consider them openings because like I think even if there is a dynamic in which resistance somehow is like used and exploited by power to change, and so to find other ways in which like those affirmative ways, a trajectory of a potential horizon get shut down into these closures, we don't have closures yet on these kind of aspects. Like, so when we're talking about politics from those perspectives, from the perspective of aesthetics and from the perspective of metaphysics, like we still have the potential to extract from these trajectories of theoretical trajectories, conceptual trajectories, a lot of strength that can be used in our understanding of resistance and in our understanding of how practices, contemporary practices, can inform, can be informed by this idea. I really like the way in which I prefer to talk a little bit more about Negri's understanding of Spinoza, because like it's a very interesting way of defeating this power, this relationship between within power, between potestas and potentia, in which like basically potestas like is this idea in which power is presented as static. And I mean, like, and if you think about it, like any state is by definition static. And instead, like, you have potentia that is like this force of pushing, this potential that pushes like the state and the state of things to change continuously. Otherwise, everything will be dry, everything will be dead, right? Like, and instead, like this dynamic urge that comes from I draw the association between potentia and resistance, because obviously, and it's Negri himself that calls it a physics of resistance when he talks about Spinoza, to express this idea that like this dynamicity of being that cannot stay calm, cannot stay still, cannot be static, cannot be locked into a specific arrangement, guarantees that things keep changing. And so we constantly faced with new situations, with new dynamics, and those dynamics can always be more emancipatory, even though like we don't see that happening like on a daily basis.
Yeah, and then you kind of trace even more newer experimental trajectories in chapter 5 through materialism. Can you kind of explain how you trace those?
Yeah, last chapter, basically, I try to engage with like Deleuze and partly with the work of Guattari as well, and trying to understand how their ontology, because like they developed like a strong ontology, so a strong discourse on being, is represents like a form of radical materialism where the dynamic element is resistance as understood by Foucault. And I think like this might be partly controversial, because like especially after they fell apart like in the late 70s, it seems that Deleuze and Guattari have like a bit of take a bit of a distance from Foucault in especially on the point of resistance. But I think in his book from 1996 and in his lectures like on Foucault, there is a very clear adoption of that model, in which like he says like resistance must come first, like is a necessity for Foucault's model and for this ontological model. I think it's no coincidence that Foucault is the only author to whom Deleuze, the only contemporary author to whom Deleuze devotes a book. So he's written books like on Nietzsche, on Spinoza, but then like the only contemporary author is actually Foucault. And I think that's a very interesting point, as like it shows how the importance of creating this materialist kind of understanding of ontology necessitates an understanding of resistance, in which like there is a force that keeps changing, forces the materiality to change. The way in which I understand this materialist ontology is by cutting through entities and identities by looking at actual forces. So a microphysics of force like that you find in Foucault, to understand like how things actually interact with each other at a micro level. So even like when we find our internal struggles, so to speak, like we can understand them like into micro forces that operate in connection not just with ourselves, but like in an interrelation that is much wider, and is like at the level of materialities, where materialities like can indicate like beings, human beings, like or non-human beings, or even things or thoughts or whatever. Like, so everything is wrapped into this like material kind of understanding.
And what are some future research agendas for resistance that you kind of see? What's something that excites you most right now?
Well, that's a nice question. What I'm trying to do at the moment, like, is trying to maybe to not really to step away, but like try to take some distance from a political philosophy per se, and trying to see how this model and this set of ideas that I develop in the primacy of resistance fit with current experiences and experiments of resistance in actual practice. I think every movement, and I think that there is a lot of space for resistant movements everywhere in the world, and we see them popping up like without philosophers' intervention, obviously, like they pop up automatically anyway, everywhere, which is very beautiful. I think they all sort of support this idea in the sense that what I'm trying to say is like there is not just opposition. There is more than opposition. There is like prefiguration and construction of a different way of being or on a different alternative horizons of potentialities. And we see this happening like in every kind of context. What I've been doing, for instance, like lately, like the disconnected talks like with COVID, is trying to look at experiments with social clinics, which are basically a different way of doing healthcare, especially in a moment in which healthcare is become like a very hot topic that is for continuous attempts of privatization or full privatization in other countries, also the interest of big pharma and industries and so on. And instead having ways in which like we can create more solidaristic ways of understanding healthcare, I think it's a way of showing how this primacy of resistance doesn't necessarily go against the model, but beyond going against the model, it creates an alternative model where the affirmation of a potentiality is happening in practice.
Well, Marco, I think we've taken up a lot of your time today, so I have one final question. Where are you off to next? What are you working on now?
Well, as I was saying, like I'm working like on a number of projects, like in which I try to see resistance in practice, like how this resistance is happening. So I've been doing some work on social clinics. I've been following the case, the really interesting case of a group of activists that have occupied a hospital in Italy, which I found really interesting because like it's really unusual to think like of a hospital as like a contested space, but it's beautiful when it becomes an actual contested space. And what I've been doing in the recent past is also with a chapter in a book that is about to be published next year, is about recuperated factories. So examples of factories that have been shut down and the workers decide to occupy them and restart production. Those are really unsung like stories of success, like, but very beautiful because like they create like a whole horizon of experimentation in which we can actually see how our lives can be organized in a different way, and that's what really attracts me at the minute. So I'm following these little examples that pop up here and there, hopefully showing that the primacy of resistance can be understood also through actual activist groups and militant practices.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Kyle. Like, thank you for your questions, and thank you for the time that you offer me on this space.
Thank you, and thank you to our listeners for joining us for our discussion of Dr. Marco Checchi's new book entitled The Primacy of Resistance, Power, Opposition, and Becoming, which was recently published by Bloomsbury. Bye for now.